During the weeks of preparation, we were very conscious that on reception day, we were taking the second step, which would make us or help us to become brides of Christ. And to make this more solemn, on reception day, we really were attired as brides. So we were taken to the room in which the bridal gowns or reception days were kept. We selected the gown and veil that we'd like to wear, and we were properly fitted for reception day, and then it was set aside. And even that we tried not to think about during our retreat. What we were most intent on thinking about was the fact that on that day we were taking that second step that would make us later brides of Christ. The morning of January 27th gave me a lovely surprise. When I looked out the window, I saw that the world like today, while I'm recording, was blanketed with snow. I love snow, and that added to my joy. The sister who had been appointed to help me dress as a bride came, and she quickly helped me to get dressed. When I left my room in the convent to meet the other Jew, I was astonished at how beautiful they looked. We didn't have mirrors in those days, and I didn't know how I looked, but I knew how they looked. And it really made me very, very happy. We were met at the cloister door by our little girl angels, girls dressed in white and each carrying a silver tray on which lay a folded habit, the cincture with our long rose, side rosary, and our white veils. It had been planned that my sister Frances be my angel, but during the practice time before reception day, we discovered that she, being only seven, could not manage the big tray. So she was appointed then to carry the smaller tray on which lay Sister Dorothy's ring and crucifix. You remember Sister Dorothy was a novice who was being professed, or who was making her first vows on that same day. Together beside each of us, beside our angel, walked down the aisle. We filed into one front pew and Sister Dorothy into the other. Our angels went forward, placing the silver trays on the communion railing. Then Mass was begun. I had noticed when we were coming into chapel that my family was there, except my father. Later, I found that he had been elected a delegate to a miners' convention. And, of course, I missed him very much. Andrew, who was the only two, kept saying to Mama, "Which is Mary Jane? Which one is Mary Jane?" Mama gave him her rosary and he dangled and played with that. Then finally he dropped a dime that Mama had given him on the floor and he just begged to go and get it. Finally, Mama shooshed him up some way, I don't know how, and as the mass went on, he really did become more quiet. Father paused when in an early part of the mass and came to the communion reading and blessed our habits. Then for the first time, I really realized why they were called holy habits. They were blessed. And then, too, I discovered that that was why we kiss the cross embroidered on the back of the habit. It was there to remind us that the habit was blessed and that as brides of Christ, who was a suffering Christ, that we too would have crosses to bear. Immediately after the blessing of the habits, our angels went forward, each picking up the tray containing the habit that her novice would wear. Then, preceding us, we went to the cloister door where a sister met us and took the habits, and our angels waited for us again outside the cloister door. In a very short time, we had changed from our bridal attire into the blessed habits, which we hoped we would wear always. And then we returned to chapel. We went directly to the communion railing, where Father was waiting for us. He blessed each one of us particularly, and as he gave the blessing, he bestowed upon each of us our new name, the name that we would bear as sisters the rest of our days. In those days, we did not choose our names, and when they were chosen by the superior or the novice mistress. And the name that I received was completely unfamiliar to me. So that later, when we came from chapel after mass, someone asked me, "What's your new name?" I said, "I don't know. I don't know what Father said." Then Mother Brunner stepped forward and she said, "Your name is Sister Mary Eugenia." And then, of course, I heard the names of the other two. But now we will go back to the completion of the Mass. After Mass, during which we received Holy Communion, and just before the communion, Sister Dorothy, who was making her vows with her angel, went to the communion railing and knelt there, promising in her vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience to be true to Christ for the rest of her days. Then Father blessed the ring and placed it on her finger and gave her the crucifix, a rather large one, which she would wear over her heart. We novices, of course, did not receive the ring or the crucifix. These were given only when we would later make our vows. During that reception day, my family and I, and the other families who just became known to each other at that time, had a very happy time. And in the evening, when after they had left, and we had said our night prayer and were ready for bed, I reached out and touched the hem of that long black habit, which I hoped someday I would wear, even in death. But times have changed, and later on, as I tell my story, you will learn that today I'm dressed quite differently. You would also learn that the reception ceremony, as I have described it here, is very much simpler. In fact, I feel that we have lost something in dispensing with these things or in changing them. But after all, we're living in a modern age, and Saint Angela, our foundress, told us that we would need to change because the order would go on and on. And she told us then, if changes are necessary, make them after due consultation and prayer and consideration. And as I continue, you will see how we have adapted ourselves to this request of hers. The period of the novitiate, or the time during which we were novices, covered 2 years. And during that time, many changes were being made, because we had our convent and many others had joined the Roman Union. I would like to explain that here, but I think it would take too long. And now, on January 27th, 1906, my life as a novice, a white-veiled novice, as an Ursuline sister, began. During this time, again, we did no teaching. We studied not only our rules and constitutions, the meaning of the vows that we would take on our vow day, but we also did some secular studying. And by the time I had finished my novitiate, I was pretty nearly finished with a great part of my high school work. Towards the end of this novitiate period, we went to Dallas, Texas, to finish a part of our training. and it was there on February 22nd, 1908, my companions and I made our first vows. Sometimes it seems odd that it would have been on that day, but since we were in our novitiate was there in Dallas, was a part of the community, and that was a boarding school, we had to find a day that would be free, which would not be a Sunday. And it happened that Washington's birthday was that day. So forever after, Washington's birthday has been a red letter day for me. That our vow day was preceded by another 8-day retreat. By that time, we had definitely decided that we wanted to be sisters, that we wanted to make vows, that with God's help, we would be able to keep them. So on that morning of February the 22nd, I vowed poverty, chastity, and obedience for 3 years. The following day, on February 23rd, my two companions and I returned to Alton. Since this was the middle of the year, there were no open places for teachers. All of them had been assigned at the beginning of the school year. But I'm not a novice anymore. I'm professed. And we young professed juniors, as we were called, had time again to do a great deal of studying and a great deal of helping around the house where help was needed. And we also many, many times substituted in the two parochial schools of the city. I remember one day that I substituted in the morning at one of them and in the afternoon at the other. In this way, we really had our practice teaching, and it was very good experience for us. Then when summer came, when school closed, we had our annual retreat. And right at the end of the retreat, which usually closed on the 15th of August, we were given our assignments, and I was assigned to teach in the old cathedral school, which was located in Alton, Illinois. At that time, the old school, which was very dilapidated, was down in a hollow, and we knew that a new school would eventually be erected. I didn't expect it to be put up in my time, but it really happened. The new school was to be built right next to the cathedral itself. And perhaps people may wonder why I called it the old cathedral. I did that because at the time that I'm recording about right now, Alton was the seat of the bishop of the diocese, and his church, of course, is called the cathedral. And it's called that because the bishop's throne, or chair, is in that church. No other church in the diocese has that. Therefore, that word comes from ex cathedra, because when the Holy Father speaks to the church in general, we say he is speaking ex cathedra, and that was true of a bishop when he was speaking for his diocese. And strangely enough, at that time, I think I'm correct in saying this, the bishop at that period was the bishop who earlier had administered to me the sacrament of confirmation. I'm pretty sure it was Bishop Ryan. The next year, when the assignments were given out, I was again, as we say, missioned to the cathedral school. By this time, the new school had been built. So my first 2 years of teaching experience were gained there. And I think you might enjoy this. There were five of us on the faculty. Sisters Angela, Magdalene, Eugenia, Loretta, and Catherine. Sister Loretta was a real witty person. And one day, she said something about being the tail of the camel. We were nonplussed. We couldn't imagine what she was talking about. Well, she said, stop a minute and think. We still couldn't figure it out. She said, all right, on this faculty, there is Catherine, Angela, Magdalene, Eugenia, and Loretto, and she's the tail of the camel. When the appointments came out after our retreat in 1911, I discovered I had been commissioned to Decatur. 68 years ago, when a 22-year-old sister stepped from the Wabash train in the small town of Decatur, population 30,000 at that time. I little dreamed that I was going to live there the rest of my days. My companion, Sister Edmund, and I were met by a courteous gentleman who guided us to a coach. I discovered later that this coach was one of J.J. Moran's funeral coaches, and that the gentleman was one of the chauffeurs. We reached the convent, which was very near the station, just in time for lunch. The nuns who were there already gathered around us and welcomed the two of us very gladly. It was great to have two more young sisters added to their staff. After lunch, which we enjoyed, we were given a tour of the house. And as we went from room to room, I heard one of the nuns who had been in Decatur telling Sister Edmund something about that house having been a hotel at one time. This intrigued me, and being intensely interested in history of any kind, I determined to learn the history of that house. And this I did pretty shortly. I discovered in my probing and testing and questioning that house had been built in 1854. It had been planned by a Mr. Humphrey, who had foreseen the need for a hotel in that location. The building contained 12 rooms. It had been built of some of the first handmade bricks in Decatur. They were porous, and the moisture easily seeped through, as did the cold. The only way they could heat the house was by the use of two heaters, which certainly didn't keep the place very comfortable. The hotel was successful for a time, but later on, Mr. Humphrey went bankrupt. Then the building passed into the hands of a Mr. Murphy. He used it as a boarding house for quite a while. About 1865 or so, the pastor at St. Patrick's Church at that time planned to bring teaching sisters to Decatur. He therefore rented the Farmer Hotel to be used as a convent. The pastor brought a group of Canadian sisters, and they lived in the house for perhaps 5 years. These sisters spoke French. They were very far from their mother house, and there were so many difficulties that they, after about 5 years, abandoned the attempt to start a school. But they had begun it under the name of the Academy of St. Teresa, and it has borne that name even to this date. After this group left, another pastor, or perhaps it was the same one, went to New York to obtain sisters to staff the school. We could never understand why he did this, because since he had a relative in the Dominican Order in Springfield, Illinois, which was very near, and there were also Ursuline sisters in that same city. However, he did that. He went to New York. A group of the 8 sisters came, and a remarkable thing about them was the fact that all of them were in their 20s. Among them was a little sister named Sister Baptista Hart. And in March of 1873, she became ill and was buried in the priest's lot in our Calvary Cemetery here in the city. For many years, no real record concerning her was unearthed until I began doing some research. And then I found that she had come with this group, and evidently she had been praying for somebody's conversion. And it seems to me that she must have promised God if he would grant, she would go on this mission, and would he please grant the conversion. Now, we don't know whether the conversion came about for sure, but I myself am positive that God could not have failed to answer that prayer. And I later, when I was doing research, wrote to Sister Rose Finan in New York, and she gave me the details that I have just enumerated. This group of sisters remained only 1 year from the summer of 1872 till the close of school in 1873. Then they returned to New York. Before proceeding, I would like to correct an idea which many people have about the location of the old convent, and I would like to show too the progress that has been made. In 1872, the corner house on El Dorado and Jackson Street on the north side was the Peter Mooney home. Next to it was Dr. Fitzpatrick's home, and then the old convent was the third building in that block. Today, the armory covers the site on which these three buildings stood. When I came to Decatur, I discovered that if I stood on the front porch of the convent and the doors of St. Patrick's Church were open, I could look directly into the sanctuary. In the summer of 1873, the pastor of St. Patrick's decided to contact the Alton community to obtain sisters to staff the school. He obtained six sisters, and that group was headed by Mother Teresa Gillespie, who in the capacity of being superior, reading now is regarded as the foundress of that house as far as Ursulines are concerned. By this time, the St. Patrick's congregation had purchased the Humphrey House to be used as a convent. When these nuns arrived, they naturally followed the rules of our order, and only girls were taught in the academy. There was a school somewhere near where the boys were taught by the Christian brothers. Then in 1882, the building east of the convent, quite a large building at that time, was erected. And at that time, both boys and girls were taught in the same classes. These early sisters endured very many hardships, and things were not much better when I came to Decatur in 1911. Although we did have steam heat, and the rooms, I think, had been renovated to such an extent that they were at least endurable. But as the days passed, we found that we definitely could not live in that building very much longer. In the summer of 1912, we elected Mother Celestine O'Rourke as our superior. After her election, we were sitting around visiting with our provincial when she said to Mother, "There's only one thing that worries me." And Mother said, "What's that?" And she said, "The fact that you're all so young." And Mother replied smilingly, "We will correct that fault day by day." And certainly we have done that. Only two of the 12 who were in that group are still living. Those two are Sister Paul Brewer and I, Sister Eugenia. Mother Celestine was very intelligent and energetic and far-seeing. We all knew that we had property, a 33-acre tract of land on the north side of the city on the Bloomington Road, but we certainly have no funds. But Mother Celestine, who had a great trust in divine providence, determined that we were going to get a building on that tract of land as soon as possible. So she and her counselors went to lawyer Fitzgerald and explained the situation to him. He inquired more deeply concerning the funds we had. When Mother replied we had none, all we had was the property, he sat back and looked at them in amazement, and he said, "Well, you people are either angels or fools." And Mother said laughingly, "Whichever we are, we need the loan." And they got it. In the meantime, great activities were going on. Since the old St. Patrick's School, which we had been using, was so dilapidated, a new school had to be built. So the old church, which stood on the corner of North and Jackson, was demolished, and the new school was begun there. It was ready for occupancy by February 1913, and what a joy it was to move into a school like that. 8 rooms, polished floors, single seats. It just was unbelievable. And of course, we did all we could to keep it in prime condition. by the early months of spring, plans for the new building, which we hope to erect, were almost perfected. And we had in mind just one wing of a much larger building, which we hoped to erect later on. We were to have a main building and a wing similar to the one that was being planned. By the beginning of May, plans were ready to be carried out. And on May the 12th, 1913, the ground was broken for the beginning of the wing that we had hoped to erect at first. By August the 15th of that same year, 1913, the framework was up, and Mother Celestine was anxious for all of us to get at least a peep at what was going to be our future home. She and her counselors had been out many times, but the rest of us had not seen it. So on August the 15th, we had an all-day picnic here on the convent grounds. The carpenters were busy at work when we arrived, and by the way, we came in, I think, a carriage of some kind, and then Miss Margaret Burke, who was a very good driver and who had helped us many times when we needed transportation in the city. And she, by the way, was the first licensed woman driver in Macon County and the second in the state. She was driving her own car, and the remainder of the group came in buggies or carriages of some kind. We arrived almost at noontime, and Miss Burke and her friend, Miss Hayes, who later became known as Sister Isabel, here at St. Teresa's, prepared our lunch. In the meantime, we younger nuns had run as fast as we could to the framework of the building and began climbing ladders, walking over the joists, balancing on beams, until we had the carpenters speechless. We explored every nook and corner that we possibly could. And just about that time, the two ladies called us for lunch. We had an immense lunch, so immense that we invited the carpenters to share it, and they very happily acquiesced. We laughed and talked for some time. And then the girls finally shooed us away and told us to go look at the grounds now, which we did. We found, to our dismay almost, that we really were going to be the lonely house on the hill. The only other houses around were Downing's Place, the Little Jones School, a part of the Macon County Hospital, the Oglesby School, and the Pythian Home. As we went over the property, we discovered, running probably through the center of it, a little creek that we have not known was there. We young people had great fun holding up our skirts and jumping from one side of the creek to the other. As we walked over the grounds, we were amazed at how large it really was. It seemed so great compared to the small yard at the old convent, where we had only narrow walks to go up and down. Finally, the girls called us, and they had already packed the picnic things into the vehicles. We climbed in, very tired, but very happy. Now we could hardly wait until that whole building was completed. By December the 22nd, 1913, that dream had come true. And when we went out a few days before moving day, we just couldn't believe our eyes. 50 big rooms, such a palace to live in. We just couldn't believe it. Then on the 22nd of December, Father Murphy dismissed St. Patrick's at noon so that the faculty there could come out and help with the moving. The vans came early in the morning. I think there were two of them, and they were loaded. It took quite a bit of loading to get everything in. Although we had sent a great deal of the furniture out ahead of time. And when later, on the evening of December the 22nd, and we wanted to set up beds, we found that they were piled under all the other furniture. So we had to unpack everything to get to them. We did that and carried them up four flights of steps. We had no elevator at that time. And almost before we knew it, it was supper time, which comes at our house at 6 o'clock. We didn't have any table. We had no chairs, except I think one. Their paint buckets were all over the place. But we decided we would use one of the big rooms on the first floor. One of the nuns, Sister Gabriel, who wasn't able to help with the unpacking, had been busily peeling peaches. Apples. And she had made applesauce. So for our supper that evening, we had applesauce, tea, and bread and butter. And for many days after, that was our daily menu. We finally got Mother Celestine settled in the chair, and we young people sat on the floor, Turk fashion, and we had a delightful time eating our supper. And we went to bed good and tired, but happy. And Christmas Eve came almost before we knew it, but we had things pretty well straightened up, and we were ready for our first Christmas in our new home. Of course, we had no resident pastor, and therefore, we had to attend Mass at St. Patrick's. We did this by starting out, some of us, to attend the 5 o'clock Mass. And I think we went on the trolley car, at least some of us did. Then J.J. Moran's had sent out some coaches, and some of the sisters went to the later masses in these coaches. And this became a regular Sunday schedule for quite a long time. And because of this schedule, Sunday morning breakfasts extended sometimes till noon. On December 30th, the new academy was blessed, and it was formally opened to students in January 1914. Of course, this was a school for girls only, and it was in the one wing of the building that had just been dedicated. It was only later on that new buildings were added. Of course, the St. Patrick's staff still continued to teach in St. Patrick's School. We went out to school every morning and returned in the evening. And those were very hard trips. There, we had to make them, most of them, by trolley car. And because there were no paved roads or streets, yeah, it was very difficult to get back and forth. And very often we had to stand on Marietta Street waiting for the cars when we transferred. Because we were outside the city limits, we didn't come in, if you can believe it, until 1952. No deliveries were made, I suppose, not only to us, but to maybe any of the other people that lived near us. At any rate, the St. Patrick's staff had to be the delivery boys. During the day, the sister who had charge of the buying would see to it that we had gotten the necessary bread, the meat, the milk, and whatever else would be needed for the next few days. And some very funny things happened because of this fact. One day, Sister Edmund had some loaves of bread, which, by the way, were not wrapped separately in those days, in her arm. Somehow or other, as she stepped into the trolley car, the man behind her was very close to her, and in some way she dropped a loaf of bread. He didn't see it, and consequently kicked it to the other end of the car. Of course, we nuns, who always see the funny side of things, burst out laughing. The other passengers joined in. And by doing things like that, which seemed so silly at the time, but when I look back, really seemed important, because it was through those little things that people began to realize what kind of people we were. Some of them had no idea what sisters were like. Then another day, somebody who was carrying the milk pail bumped against the bucket, and the lid flew off, and it went sailing down the aisle. And again, somebody retrieved it, and we had another good laugh. And other incidents happened, too. We were doing our best to reach out to people, to make friends with them, to let them know us as human beings. And little by little, we did manage to break down a great deal of their reserve, and they did become very friendly. But there was one lady that we just didn't seem to be able to reach at all. And one morning when we got on the trolley car, there was no place, no empty seat except right next to her. So one of the sisters asked if she might sit there. The lady rather curtly acquiesced, and sister sat down. And then she began talking to the lady. And at first, she didn't respond very well. But little by little, as we went day after day, and we did reach out to her, she became friendly enough to talk to us. And then we invited her to come over to the convent sometime. During the summer, we had to do our house cleaning because there was no other time to do it at the big house cleaning that housewives do in the spring. So we had our habits pinned up and getting my aprons on and our sleeves pinned up and our veils pinned up. And we just happened to be cleaning the parlor in the front hall. The doorbell rang. One of the nuns, dressed just as she'd been in her scrub outfit, went to the door. And who was there but our friend? She didn't, the sister spoke to her, and she was so astonished she couldn't answer. She just looked at all of us. And then she said, "I never dreamed that you people could do work like that," she said. "I thought all you did was teach school and crochet." In those early days, we really suffered in many ways, and we were trying very hard to get the debt paid on our house as fast as we could. So in order to supplement our meager salaries, we raised vegetables and sold them. We had chicken fries, we had bazaars, and we had ice cream socials, and we invited everybody to come to these things. They served two purposes, at least the last few named ones, because people came from all over the city, Catholics and non-Catholics alike. And in that way, we became known to many people, and we made very many friends. And I would like to say right here that we owe a debt to the people of Decatur, both Catholic and non-Catholic, that we can never repay. Although we had a mass on Sunday, although we attended masses on Sunday at St. Patrick's, we had mass only once or twice a week here in the convent in those early days. And Father Andrew Smith, who was the assistant pastor at St. Patrick's, came out to either say mass or give us a Holy Communion. Sometimes he would get as far as Downing's, and because of huge snow drifts, our great puddles of mud that he couldn't pedal through. He would hide his bicycle in the bushes at Downing's and come the rest of the way on foot. In 1915, we had the joy of securing a resident priest, a refugee priest from Mexico. Father Shapiro came, and for the next few years, we had resident chaplains. We had our first Sunday Mass, I think, in June, after Father came, and it was a joy to be able to have our own services in our own chapel and have a regular schedule on Sunday. As I mentioned before, we had gone to school most of the time and to church also, either by trolley car or in Moran's coaches. Later on, someone gave us an old horse, an old mare named Nellie, and with the horse came a two-seated surrey with the fringe on top.